I got it from us.
Welcome, everyone. I will call the Joint Committee on Marijuana Regulation to order, and we will start tonight by opening a work session on Senate Bill 863. And as you recall, we had a hearing on the bill last week, and we've had some discussions since, and so we have a dash one amendment. So, Adam, do you want to just go over?
Madam Chair, members of the committee is being asked to consider the dash two amendments. The dash two amendments replace the measure. They prohibit a marijuana retailer from recording or retaining information that may be used to identify a customer, provides an exemption for customers that all voluntarily offer their name and contact information for marketing purposes, prohibits a marijuana retailer from transferring information that may be used to identify a consumer, and requires marijuana retailers to destroy any information that may be used to identify a consumer within 30 days of the effective date. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. There is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Thank you. And I would like to call our drafter and legislative counsel, Mark Mayer, up here. There was a little confusion around the dash two amendment, and I want to make sure people understand that this amendment applies only to recreational customers. So, Mark.
Chairs Leininger, my name is Mark Mayer, Legislative Counsel. The issue with the dash twos that was a little confusing is whether or not it would apply to the registry identification card number of an OMMP patient. And what the bill or what the amendment applies to is information that may be used to identify a consumer, defined to mean information that may be acquired through the production of a piece of identification described in ORS 475B170. Whether the information is acquired through one of those pieces of identification or otherwise. And if you look at that statute, it names driver's license, military card, other identification card issued by the Department of Transportation, and the information on those types of documents is name, age, sex, description, physical description, sometimes a photo ID. Those would be the types of information that would be prohibited from being retained and recorded. The registry identification card number itself on an OMMP issued card doesn't fall in that definition, and so it's not going to apply to that. And then we also worked with the Department of Revenue just to make sure that they would be able to get the information they need out of this amendment for purposes of tax relief.
Okay. Senator Krasinski, did you have further comments on this?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to acknowledge both Senator Farioli and Representative Wilson. At our last meeting, I got the message, keep it simple, stupid. And so that's what we've done. We basically have taken out the stuff that dealt with OHA. I think that's another issue, another day for us to look at. So this is basically dealing on the recreational side, and we also understood that it was important and imperative for the Department of Revenue to be able to have a cross-check as to honoring individuals that have a card who are not required to pay a tax on the product that they buy, and ensuring that those who are in the retail side have the ability to do the cross-reference checking that needs to be filed with the Department of Revenue to ensure that they have the authority to not pay the tax. And so that's been done through this process. It does, in fact, allow for that information that needs to be captured to do verification that the cardholder is, in fact, the cardholder, and that the store was correct in not taxing the individual. So I want to also acknowledge Mark Mayer for his work in putting this together to ensure that we are going to be able to impact the, let's say, the databasing of information where the individual consumer has chosen or would choose not to do this. So it's all voluntary. It will, in fact, allow for the retail outlets to continue or to go forward and have a marketing program that consumers who want to be a part of it can, in fact, sign up to do that. And it also will, in fact, as stated in the at the end of the dash two amendments on section three, require all of the currently stored data to be taken out of their system and destroyed. So this will kind of give a clean slate, and it also will give Oregonians, I think, a better understanding and security as to making certain that their personal information is not being stored against their will and knowledge. And it also will limit even the information that will be used for the commercial side to specific information that is not data sensitive for identity theft. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Senator Pisanski. And in the spirit of keeping it simple, this is a simple change in the law to not keep records on recreational marijuana buyers. In the past, when during early sales, those records were retained by the dispensaries. They will no longer be retained for any period of time, and the ones that have been stored will be destroyed. So with that, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. I moved to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 9th, 2017.
Senator Farioli has moved the Dash 2 amendments dated March 9th, 2017. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? So ordered. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move the Senate Bill 863 is amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Farioli has moved Senate Bill 863 as amended to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Farioli.
This is a bill that has an emergency clause, so we will be carrying it as such and explaining the need to move swiftly to protect the privacy of folks who have availed themselves of the recreational system.
Thank you for that comment,
defending
Senator
the emergency clause on this bill.
Is there any other further discussion beyond this landmark discussion that we just heard? Okay. Are there any objections? So ordered. Senator Farioli, would you carry this,
yes,
please? And Representative Wilson, would you care to carry this on the House floor?
I will.
Thank you. Okay, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 863. And our next item is a brief informational meeting on where we stand on lab testing requirements. We have Jeff Rhodes from the Governor's Office and Andre Urso from Oregon Health Authority. And you may have somebody else you want to bring up. Oh, and Ms. Shannon O'Fallon. Welcome. And what we're looking for here is there's just been a lot of flux in the lab world, and just want to find out what the status is now. There were regulations and then temporary regulations, and now there's proposed regulations, and so we just want to get a fix on where we are right now.
Absolutely.
So
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Rhodes. I'm a senior policy advisor to Governor Kate Brown, covering the topic of marijuana. Thank you for inviting us to speak to you here today. And in order to provide an appropriate context for this informational presentation, I'm sort of organizing this as where we were, where we are, and where we're going. And I'll be covering a little bit of the historical context of the past few months. As the chair has alluded to, we've had a lot of developments in the world of testing over the past couple of months, starting on October 1st. And then Andre Urso will be covering the proposed testing rules from the Rules Advisory Committee. And those reflect some excellent discussions we've had. This has been an incredibly difficult topic area, and I think you'll agree once we go through it, we have a lot of considerations, a lot of competing interests to weigh. We also have Shannon O'Fallon from Department of Justice here, who has graciously lent us her time as a lifeline for the really hard questions. So let's get started here with cannabis testing in Oregon. And as I said, incredibly complicated topic that I could take up the entire evening talking about. And I guess I'll just use the arrows here. I thought it would be helpful to just start with a quick overview of where the authority for cannabis testing comes from. It comes from 475B555. This statute directs the Oregon Health Authority to adopt cannabis rules as is necessary to testing rules as is necessary to protect the public health and safety, and it's done in consultation with the OLCC and the Department of Agriculture, and sets out the various, as you can see, testing categories that we test for. Also has a catch-all for other contaminants as well. The statute also mandates that our environmental lab accreditation body, or ORLAB, accredits the labs and that OLCC license them. And the legislature created really important sideboards on this process. While the rules must be promulgated as is necessary to protect the public health and safety, they also must be done with an eye towards cost and in a manner which is not considered to be overly burdensome. These are things that we're constantly considering as we move forward looking at proposed rule changes and what we're hearing is going on out there in the community. I should say, this has not been an easy balancing test. We do lack appropriate safety guidance from federal agencies that are normally regulating in this area. The Environmental Protection Agency, which sets a lot of the standards for pesticide testing, is absent completely from this process, and that sort of leaves us to regulate on our own. And we're really true pioneers in this area. We're on the frontiers of cannabis testing, we rely on the expertise of the industry, of folks that are in agencies that have testing and food safety experience very heavily to figure out what direction we should be moving in and to make certain that we are going in the appropriate direction. So prior to October 1st of 2016, the landscape of lab testing was markedly different than it is now. Labs were not yet accredited by ORLAP or licensed by OLCC, and that meant that there was no check on certain processes to make certain that they were correct and that we were having consistent results from the labs. Indeed, we heard from folks that businesses would shop around for labs that would provide the most marketable results. This was frequently in the context of potency, higher potency products being more valuable in the marketplace, and thus folks would go to the lab that was showing the highest potency results from the test and then put that product out to market with that result. That has significant ramifications on the consumer side, and the labs also had no oversight and thus little incentive to procure appropriate instrumentation or put in place these processes and procedures. The lack of advanced equipment was an important point. Testing for pesticides is very complicated and difficult and requires very expensive instrumentation. I think on one of my tours recently of a lab, I was told each one of these instruments costs a house, and they're incredibly complicated instruments and necessary to test appropriately for pesticides. But additionally, there's no one working with the labs to meet the appropriate standards and make certain that they are putting processes in place, checking those processes, and double-checking them. There can be no mistake, though. This was a cheaper system, and that testing was significantly cheaper before October 1st. After October 1st, the landscape shifted significantly. Labs were now required to be licensed and accredited through ORLAP and by OLCC. And ORLAP accredits to the TNI standards. This helped to standardize processes and procedures and ensure more accurate results. And I do have to do a little bit of a shout out here. ORLAP had an incredibly heavy lift to get as many labs accredited by the deadline as they can. With limited resources, they put in a very heroic effort and did an excellent job. And then also provided feedback to shepherd these labs through the process and help them with questions that they had. But, of course, things were not perfect. Immediately, we heard very valid concerns from industry groups that testing had become overly cumbersome, overly burdensome. And while ORLAP did an excellent job of getting labs online, we still did not have enough accredited labs to test for pesticides, creating a bottleneck and really putting a damper on things. I should say, I believe the committee should have this up on the dais, we've provided a list of labs that are now accredited through ORLAP. We now have 8 labs licensed and accredited to test for pesticides. So we're moving significantly in the right direction. And this document also lays out the other labs and what they are accredited to test for, potency, solvents, and so on and so forth. Additionally, with the October 1st rules, the process validation, which was originally conceived of to be a cost-saving measure, proved to be too costly, and especially in the context of smaller and medium-sized businesses that didn't have the upfront capital to go through process validation on the front end. So Governor Brown heard these concerns loud and clear. We convened a meeting with involved agency heads to discuss the cost of testing and its impact to Oregon businesses. And that meeting produced some excellent results in the form of December 2nd temporary rules. These rules responded directly to industry concerns and rolled back the cost of testing in certain areas. However, we were also cognizant of our obligation to provide for public health and safety concerns and had to be careful not to just roll back too far, too soon. And after all, this committee has heard, I believe now on multiple occasions, there are illegal pesticides out there in our products, and we have had failed tests throughout this process. So this slide shows you the two, the December 2nd rules, the temporary rules that we put in place as a result of that meeting and our industry concerns, benchmarked against the October 1st rules and where we were before the temporary rules. They are valid until May 30 of 2017. And this just gives you a little bit of an idea of what we were looking at. One of the big things we did was the replacement of process validation with the control study. Process validation required three rounds, whereas the control study requires one round. So that was a significant cost-saving measure for people that were going to go through the control study process. In addition, we removed certain solvents from the list. This was done directly from hearing from industry groups in the context of Rick Simpson Oil is a great example that uses an ethanol. This was a substance that our toxicologists were telling us was not providing any risk to the public by being in there. And indeed, we were holding up some pretty important products from patients and from the recreational marketplace. And so in response to that, in direct response to that, those alcohol-based solvents were removed from the solvent list and are no longer tested for. Another issue that we dealt with was labeling in food safety. And what we heard was there was a lot of difficulty, especially in the context of edible products, with labeling and making certain that they were within the potency limits because of just the way that testing works. It was difficult to get down to an exact number. And indeed, we instituted a plus or minus 5% on potency for labeling there to try to ease the burden on the people that were having concerns with that issue. We also eased sampling requirements. We talked a lot to businesses out there that were going through the sampling process, and they were learning as our labs were learning as well. And in response to those concerns, we made some adjustments to, one example, combining batches for potency, provided the batches are the same strain, but then also allowing for combining of batches for pesticide testing as long as certain requirements were met as well. Again, this was all done out of a desire to try to work with the industry and figure out where the holdups were and take cost into account, but again, with an eye towards public safety. So our work was far from over after December 2nd. The rules are only good, as I said, until May 30th of 2017, and we certainly wanted to vet further suggestions from industry, from labs, from regulators, from everybody that has a stake here. A rules advisory committee was formed with this specific purpose in mind, and for this process, we assembled an expert team. It was comprised of members from OCA, OCBC, the Sun Grown Growers Guild, Greenleaf Labs, OG Analytical, as well as state regulators and toxicologists and Andre and other folks as well. It was an excellent discussion that was had at the Rules Advisory Committee and a very diverse group of stakeholders, each with important expertise that they were bringing to the table. Public comment will be held from March 15th until April 30th on the current proposed rules, which Andre is going to go through after me. But I just want to do a little solicitation here. We strongly encourage participation in the process, in the public comment process. The comments are very important. We're going to be reading them and weighing them as we look at what we're going to be doing moving forward. But I can't overstate how much we value the input of the industry and the public and everybody that has a stake in these really important changes. So I've included my contact information, and I think everybody knows how to get in touch with me, but in the presentation. And with that, I'll turn it over to Andre.
Thank you. And if you could be very brief, we've got a big hearing in front of us. So
sure.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andre Uso. I'm the manager of the medical marijuana program with the Oregon Health Authority. And while we're getting these slides set up, I'll just go ahead and get started with my presentation. So as Mr. Rhodes alluded to, in the next slide is fine. We have gone through an extensive rulemaking process around testing. It started with the adoption of the permanent rules back in June of 2016. They became effective in October. Since then, we've released two temporary rules trying to alleviate some of the concerns of the industry after the October 1st rules were released. So between February and recently in March, we've had the RAC, where we had three meetings and some good discussions on how we could further amend these rules. As Mr. Rhodes has said, that the public comment period will be open from March 15th to April 30th, and then we're hoping that these rules will become effective June 1st. So I just want to let you know here what's going on with what the standards are for testing of particular marijuana products and usable marijuana. So currently, usable marijuana that's intended to go to a consumer, so that something that the consumer would buy at this, a retail store, has to be tested for pesticides, water activity, moisture content, and then potency, so THC and CBD. The proposed rules don't change this for usable marijuana at all. And then a producer grower, you know, must test every batch of harvest lot of marijuana, usable marijuana, for micro contaminants upon request from the authority or the commission. So that option is there. And then a wholesaler may order and arrange for testing as opposed to the producer or grower. So they could take on that cost through contract if they'd like. Next slide, please.
Gotcha.
Okay. So the batch testing for pesticides for usable marijuana. Currently, 100% of all medical batches are tested for pesticides, and one-third of batches for usable marijuana that go through the OLCC system are tested for pesticides. What's proposed, that there's no change there on the medical side, and we've created a rule where we give OLCC more flexibility on determining how many batches and the ratio of batches out of a harvest lot should be tested. But there's a floor of 20%, so they could always go higher. They could have up to 100% of batches tested. We're just saying that the minimum would be one out of every five batches.
Madam Co-Chair. Do you want the presentation to come first and then questions, or should we ask while we're going through the slides?
You know, to save time, why don't we just do it briefly while you're going through the slides?
Andre, on that last, the no change on the medical, can you just walk us through the rationale as to why still 100% there versus giving the flexibility for OLCC?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Brzezinski. So a lot of it has to do with the vulnerability of the population. So these are medical patients. They might be immunocompromised. They may have illnesses where, you know, a normal person like you and I with no illness could take some small amounts of pesticides. We just want to be careful here and ensure that safety for their patients.
Thank you.
Okay, so this is a usable marijuana that would be intended for a processor, so it's not going to end up on a store directly, but might end up in a product such as an edible, anything that would be intended for human consumption or applied to a person's skin or hair. So right now, currently, it would include water activity and moisture content, and then that type of testing could be foregone if the processor uses a method that effectively sterilizes the batch of usable marijuana. What's proposed is that for that aspect, that is the same. However, we included that usable marijuana should be tested for pesticides if it's intended to be used in a product that's meant for human consumption. And now these are the testing requirements for concentrates or extracts. So this is the product that's already been processed at this point. Currently, that last, that end product needs to be tested for pesticides, solvents, and potency. Can be exempt from testing for solvents if they didn't use a solvent. So obviously there's no need for testing there. It can be exempt from solvent testing if they use a mechanical extraction process to separate the cannabinoids, or if they only use water, animal fat, or vegetable oil to separate cannabinoids. So then solvent testing wouldn't be necessary there. What's proposed here is that we would keep this the same, except for we're providing an option for extract and concentrate manufacturers, is that if they can prove that all of their usable inputs, their trim or their flower, in processing has already been tested and passed for pesticides, then they would have the option of submitting to randomized annual testing of their end product. And we would come along once a year at an unknown time and say, this process lot today gets tested for pesticides, and that would fulfill their commitment for public safety on that end. And of course, nothing in the rule prohibits the authority of the commission from coming at any point in time and asking for any random testing for any of the analytes that we've talked about today. And then if someone does fail those random tests, then we do have a process to get them back on track, where we would have a kind of a scheduled testing for them to make sure that any future process lots were free of pesticides. Okay, so lastly, testing requirements for edibles and cannabinoid products intended for consumption or ingestion. Right now, it's just potency. That's so if you have a cookie or a chocolate, just needs to make sure that you know the potency of the product, and we're not proposing any changes for these rules on that. So other notable changes to testing would be that the control study that Mr. Rhodes alluded to earlier would become a permanent option for processors. We reduced sampling for passing control studies, so they would just have to take a what we call a field sample and a duplicate, so it would just be two samples once they've passed the control study. And then they would, of course, Mr. Rhodes already alluded to this as well, they would have the ability to combine samples from multiple batches for potency and ability to combine it for pesticide testing on if they meet certain conditions. Of course, we've gotten some information anecdotally from other states that there's presence of heavy metals in cannabis, so we would want the agency to have the ability to require audit and random testing for heavy metals in the future. Some other notable options is that pesticides or solvents could be remediated from concentrate or extract products if the usable input has previously passed. So, you know, there are instances where they pass pesticide testing on the usable side, and then through the extraction or concentration process, that residual pesticide comes up to a level that would then fail. So we would allow those processors to have the option of remediating their product because we've already made sure that the input is clear of pesticides. Of course, we would want some possible remediation after consultation with the Oregon Department of Agriculture for the use of two particular pesticides, pyrethrins and piperonyl butoxide, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, PBO for short. And these two specific pesticides have pretty low toxicity and are categorized as a Category 3 pesticide by the EPA, which means that they have low risk to human health. And they're also present on ODA's list of acceptable products to use on cannabis. So we have an action level for it right now. But if they fail, we would propose that you know, talk to ODA, and ODA kind of consults with OHA or OLCC that the use was acceptable, then we would allow that producer to remediate. In addition, and finally, we would allow for quality control and research and design testing on extracts, concentrates, and products, and that would not be allowed for usable marijuana. So I'm available for any questions, and of course, here's my contact information and our OMMP website for further information.
Thank you. Before we get into questions, Jeff, could you just go over, or either of you, go over the process from here on out, how people can participate, because these are proposed rules, they're not final. Can you go over the timelines and your process for including comments and your outreach to stakeholders?
Absolutely. Would you like to cover that, Marjorie?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair. So the public can comment at any time between March 15th, which is tomorrow, to April 30th. And we prefer written comment submitted to publichealth.rules@state.or.us. We have sent out notice to the Secretary of State's office, and we'll send out a notice to interested parties tomorrow providing that information on how they can submit public comment. The agency takes public comment seriously and evaluates all public comment. In addition to written public comment for this six-week period, we'll have two public hearings where the public can come and provide oral comment, and one will be in Eugene on April 27th, I believe, and the second will be in Portland on April 28th.
Thank you. Okay, questions from the committee. Senator Cruz.
This is a specific one because you confuse me with heavy metals, which don't translocate. They aren't picked up, so why are we testing for them?
Madam Co-Chairs, it's Senator Cruz. We are not currently testing for heavy metals. What Mr. Uzo was alluding to was just a flexibility in case we needed to go in that direction, but that is not something we are currently testing for.
I've been through the heavy metals debate with DEQ for years, so just stay away from that because there's no reason to go there.
Words to the wise. Other questions from the committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess a question that I would have is, given the responsibility that we have here, how do we vouch for walking back on safety standards before the public? You know, you could kind of play this out. You know, I could look at the good representative and say, you know, you look pretty healthy. Maybe you could take a little more pesticide than those other guys do. And, you know, I'm just kind of wondering how I make that case as we test for pests.
Madam Co-Chairs and Representative Wilson, it's an excellent question. What I would say is that we are currently testing in the realm of cannabis more than we test in any other food safety arena by a long shot. The other thing that I would say is that we're sort of, as we go along, we're having to talk to toxicologists and learn what is and what isn't toxic and what can and cannot be used on these products. And one of the things we run into is that you don't have studies that deal with what happens when these are ingested by inhaling rather than if something is applied to, say, an apple and you're just eating it instead. So we weigh all of those concerns, and the concerns that you raise are real. What I would say is that we're still testing a whole bunch. We're still testing more than folks are testing in every other food safety arena, and we want to maintain that level of public safety. That's an important piece for us. But we also want to do it mindful of our statutory obligation to take a look at cost and make certain that we're not making this overly burdensome or costing Oregonians good jobs as well. So I think you've keyed in right on it. It's an incredibly difficult balancing test.
Just one quick follow-up, and that would be maybe approaching this from another direction. Am I getting more residual pesticides on, say, strawberries and apples that I'm buying from the grocery store? Am I getting more there than I am through weed with our current standards?
I'm going to take that one.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Wilson. I'm going to take a shot here. I'm not a toxicologist, and I'm not an agricultural specialist. But from what I know about the action levels that we've set, that they're higher than action levels that and tolerance levels that would be set on conventional foods. And that's because that we want laboratories to actually be able to detect them. So, you know, we have to set those levels at detection that they can reach. So to answer your question, I don't know, and I don't have that answer.
Madam Co-Chairs, if I may follow up. The difference, though, Madam Co-Chairs and Representative Wilson, is while those action limits or market assurance tests may differ from tolerance levels set by the EPA, we are testing significantly more frequently in the cannabis realm than you would see in strawberries. So you will see more safeguards in place in the stream of commerce in cannabis, significantly more than you would see for strawberries.
Okay, thank you.
And if I could just follow up on that briefly, I think one of the reasons I wanted to kind of remind people of how it was done before the testing rules went in, the proposed regulations are considerably stronger than the system we had in place from 1998 until 2015, significantly. Both the rules, the temporary rules, and the proposed rules are all much stronger than what we had before. Is that correct?
Madam Co-Chairs, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you very much. Other questions, Senator?
Yeah, Madam Chair, we tend to overly complicate things. Okay. Now, admittedly, Madam Chair, an inhaled product, there's a higher level of sensitivity than an ingested product because the ingestion, the body's meant to deal with that. But there is another inhaled product that's produced in the United States, and it's called tobacco. Okay. We're talking very similar things here. I believe the FDA has standards for that, and that would be something that could be handled by the Department of Ag. So we could know very simply that the finished product coming off the farm meets the standard, and we've solved a lot of the problems right there. We're overcomplicating this thing.
Senator Krasanski.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So I guess first I just want to make sure I heard for the record, because there are a lot of people have contacted me based on the proposed rules coming out. So we're going to have a six-week comment period that people can send stuff through mail, email, whatever, as to the comments. Is that correct?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Krasanski, yes, it is.
All right. And then I understand that there's going to be two hearings. One's going to be in Eugene on the 27th of April. And I forgot the one in Portland is scheduled for when?
For the next day on April 28th.
On the 28th. All right. So if I can just a couple of questions have come to me. I'm going to put them on the record at this point. Is that I understand that there was a RAC that kind of worked on putting this together. I've heard from some members before tonight's meeting that they looked at the proposed rules and they are kind of confused as to how the rules that are now been presented on the temporary basis doesn't reflect from their perspective what was actually being discussed, and they feel that some of the rules that are proposed were not addressed through the RAC process.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Brzezinski, I think any rules that were proposed at this RAC were discussed with the RAC members, and if I neglected to leave out a rule or two, then I will certainly email those members and let them know that I would like to have their comments.
Okay. And just one other follow-up, and that's, I guess, the percentage of failing on unsafe levels of contaminants is something around 26%, at least that's what I was told by someone that came to see me. And if that's the case, are we setting ourselves up by having a process that we're going to random testing as compared to having more rigid testing?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Brzezinski. So the numbers for failed tests apply to medical cannabis only. I'm not sure of the numbers for the OLCC market, but it's approximately 10% of usable cannabis is failing, and then about 25-26% of the concentrates and extracts is failing. It's failing because it concentrates in the pesticides, you know, even though it may pass the usable cannabis. What we've proposed going to this sort of randomized scheme for concentrates and extracts is that if the processor is going to go down that route and choose that route, we do have the safeguard that they have to show that those usable inputs have at least tested have passed pesticide testing. So that would show that the application of pesticides in the field either was non-existent or was done correctly. And then the random testing on an annual basis would kind of be that plan B backup to kind of catch anything that falls through the cracks.
And Madam Co-Chair, my understanding, kind of changing subjects a little bit on mediation of a product that has failed. My understanding is that some labs are now doing, I guess what I'm calling pre-testing, where they're trying to help their clients understand what they, you know, what it looks like in the beginning before they do all the complex testing. So you went through in your presentation saying about how this was going to potentially be addressed if you have a failure. What can you kind of walk us through as to what I thought I was hearing, depending on how they want to use it, then you're going to determine whether or not, based on what the failure is, as to whether it could be mediated to be used in some other stream or process?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Pshansky. So there's two options for remediation. One applies to concentrates and extracts, those products. So they have to show that their inputs, their usable marijuana, has already passed that testing. And if then it fails as they're going through their extraction process, they have that opportunity to remediate and see if they can get those pesticide levels below that action level. So we're going to allow them to do that, to get their product onto the market, because we're already assured that the real issue with the pesticide application in the field is already, you know, it's passed. It's not a concern. The other option for remediation is if the usable flower tests positive for the pyrethrins or the PBO. And that's because both those compounds are show up on ODA's guide list as you can use those products, but they also show up on OHA's action list saying, well, if it's over this action level, then there's some concern there. So if the producer or grower can, you know, talk to ODA, have some discussions with the Department of Agriculture, after those discussions, Ag is satisfied that the product was indeed, those two analytes were applied in an appropriate manner, then they could possibly set that usable flower aside, and over time those compounds will dissipate and be safe for consumption.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Fahey.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you, Madam Speaker. I'd like to go back to the topic of concentrates and extracts. Excuse me, I have a cold. And the 26% failure rate, and is that, that's medical product, right?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Fahey, yeah, that's correct.
Okay, and that is generally made from the 100% of the usable marijuana in the medical stream is tested.
Right.
So the 26% failure rate is made from usable marijuana that has already been tested. Is that correct?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct.
Well, okay, let's try to get out of the weeds a little bit here.
Well, I have an actual question.
Okay.
And that is, and it relates to if we're right now, there's a relatively high percentage of the concentrates and extracts that are failing, and yet we've set up what seems to be a safe harbor of if your usable marijuana is tested to use concentrates, we're rolling back the requirements there and allowing this random sampling. But it seems to me like we're using tested usable marijuana, and it's still resulting in pretty high failure rates for the testing. So I'm curious about the rationale for that change.
Madam Co-Chairs and Representative Fahey, what we're doing is trying to balance the process of how concentrates and extracts are manufactured and the risk that those businesses take as a result of that process against our ability, our lab's ability to test to a certain limit of detection and how low they can go to provide assurance that that product is clean enough to be concentrated and extracted, with the public safety concerns. And all of these competing interests have to be balanced to figure out how the most appropriate way to move forward is. So when we propose this rule, we're soliciting that input from the public to try to figure out where the best place is. It's in recognition that our concentrate makers and extractors, the good Oregon businesses, are having issues because they're not able to get assurances that their inputs are completely clean, because even if they are testing clean, the very nature of the process of concentrating a product make result in a positive test. So we're trying to think outside the box how we can continue to allow these businesses to operate while still maintaining the safety of the public. And this is one avenue that we're exploring. Remediation is another avenue that we're exploring. And that's why we're going through this rulemaking process and
But this will be fleshed out in the rulemaking process through the comments and through the hearings. We're not the rulemaking body here. I just wanted to have the committee updated because there had been so much confusion.
And Madam Co-Chair, if I could clarify for Representative Fahey. So just quickly, please. So currently, a concentrator extract processor can take the chance and not have usable marijuana tested for pesticides before they concentrate it or extract it. So they can, that's their decision, their business decision. So they could take product on faith and then make it and then test it later once the end product is out and it fails. So that's another possibility there.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Wilson, you have a very short question.
I do, just a quick one. I would wonder in this whole testing protocol what the incentive would be for a processor to turn out a 100% clean product when other people can turn out one that is not clean and still be acceptable. And so I just kind of wonder how that works, you know. But anyway, I don't need an answer now. Just wanted to convey my concern.
Thank you. All right. Well, this has been very helpful. Thank you very much. And we will close the informational hearing. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2198 with the Dash 1 amendment. And I think we'll just go right to Mark. So our drafter, Mark Mayer, is available to present the Dash 1 amendment and take questions. That pile makes me nervous.
Madam Chairs, members of the committee, I promise I won't go into too much detail here. My name is Mark Mayer, Legislative Counsel. I've been working on this amendment for about a week and a half now. And to just provide some clarity for what's different in the amendment than the bill as dropped, a lot of the provisions remain the same, and a lot of the timeline remains the same. There is a name change provision. The Oregon Medical Marijuana Program with respect to dispensaries, grow sites, and processing sites ends. That date in this bill, though, is March 30th, 2019. And again, a lot of stuff does remain the same. However, there were some additional changes to this bill. And I'll go through those very quickly with respect to the most important ones and hopefully just to provide clarity to it. The other thing that remained the same was the medical use of cannabis board is in the current draft, in the Dash 1 draft, but the provisions relating to the State Department of Agriculture regulating marijuana production are not in the draft. So the most important thing about this draft is it probably is that it contains transitional provisions for OMMA registrants that are transitioning into the OLCCC system. The most important thing with respect to those, there's two important things actually, is that there is language that is supposed to accommodate small grows with respect to being located on rural residential land, so 24 plants or smaller. And that language is currently being worked on in some more detail. And then for other license types, and this has changed a little bit in the last few days, there is going to be something called a provisional license, or what the draft calls a pre-licensure operations certificate. And that's going to allow the OMMA registrant to basically function as an OLCCC licensee until the license is processed, or the application for licensure is processed, even if that extends beyond the OMMP repeal date, March 30th, 2019. My understanding, and the commission can speak more directly to this, is that there are just simply too many registrants, especially grow sites, to process all of those applicants and make sure that they have time to get in. So the provisional licensing sections are in the draft. There are a few provisions amending the commission's regulatory powers. These are things that are modeled after the same powers they have with respect to alcohol that didn't make it into the 2015 bills. There are some provisions relating to licensee, the commission licensee, and patient cardholder interactions. Patient cardholders meaning the patients underneath the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. There are provisions that allow a certain amount of cannabinoid extract and to be included in the draft concentrate, as well as usable marijuana to be provided to cardholders for free, as well as the ability of a cardholder to go directly to a processor and pay for the processing of some of their usable marijuana instead of having to go to a retailer. There is also a rewrite of what's commonly called the bump-up statute to simplify it. Underneath the new statute, if you want the extra canopy size, you simply have to provide 75% of your usable marijuana that you harvest to cardholders for free. Rulemaking for labeling and dosage in this draft shifts to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And the final thing that is included in this draft that's of some note is that a licensee will be able to send an application or a petition, I can't remember the exact wording, into the commission that basically says, I attest to the fact that I only produce, process, or sell marijuana for medical purposes, and that I only do business with people who are registered medical growers or processors or retailers. And then they will be designated by the commission as an exclusively medical licensee. That serves a couple of purposes. The first purpose is very practical, and that's that there is an ability for cities and counties to say, we want medical establishments in our jurisdictions, but not recreational establishments. This would allow that to continue on. They would simply say, the licensees that we allow in our jurisdictions have to be exclusively medical. So that's the very practical. And then the other one would be theoretical to a degree. If there is prosecutorial pressure against businesses that engage in marijuana, this would allow people to migrate into a completely medical system underneath the commission's jurisdiction to retain that designation as purely operating for medical purposes. So those are the provisions in the draft. I'm open for questions or whatever you wish.
Okay, let's have brief questions, and then we'll move to the testimony. Senator Pozanski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I had to step out of the room, so the dash ones aren't here yet.
They're in the – I should have said that at the beginning. They're in the meeting materials, correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the dash one amendments are not through publications as of yet, so they're under proposed amendments and meeting materials. I broke the document into two different ones at the request of Rep. Helm from back in 2015, not having one large image file. So with two documents, you can do a word search within them. So.
Right. So basically, this is not – and it's something that we could act on today because it hasn't been through publication.
No, I appreciate it. I was just looking for the contents of what Mark was going through, and I'm looking at 2198, which I'm assuming is what we're on. And I've looked under amendments. It says nothing there. Now I'm looking on
meeting materials.
I'm now looking under meeting materials, and the stuff I see are basically testimonial of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people on mine.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm seeing something under proposed amendment bookmarked and searchable. Is that?
It doesn't have the label of the bill to the left.
Let's get to the bottom of this. So how do we describe this to Senator Pozanski?
Madam Chair, if members would like to click on the actual meeting over to the right-hand side of OLIS, click on that, and then to the left of agenda, meeting materials.
You got something.
And then what?
Okay, I have the main bill.
Then, Madam Chair, what you should see underneath there are two documents, proposed amendment bookmarked and searchable part one, and proposed amendment bookmarked and searchable part two. The HB 2198 draft amendments is just one large image file, all 357 pages of it. The two-part amendment is roughly 170 pages apiece.
It is there.
Maybe
I've been reading it this afternoon.
Just click your back.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, while we're waiting, I'll just describe a little bit about where we're at in the process. Our editorial staff currently has the draft. The reason why we forwarded the draft in a proposed state, or in the state it's in, the draft state, is to allow public access for a greater period of time. It took me about 10 days to work on it, and it would take editorial about the same amount of time, so that's, 20 days. We have been receiving comments from Mr. Sweet, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission's attorney. So far, all those comments are pretty minor. We should be able to work them into the draft quite easily. And there have been some other substantive issues that have been decided since then that other people can talk about. So,
other questions of Mr. Mayor? Thank you very much.
It's not where it was.
And now we will move to our witness list. We're going to start out with Don Morse and Rob Bovet.
I'm Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leininger, members of the committee. For the record, Rob Bovet, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties. I'll be incredibly brief unless you have questions. So you may recall from a couple of weeks ago that I testified about something that I had put on the table relating to land use changes to make it easier for medical growers to get into the system and go use this path and to protect their land use status, whatever that may be, and to ensure that it's not a change in use or what we call an alteration of a non-conforming use. Well, what got drafted in the bill is not what I said. And after I peeled my clients off the wall, I crafted something that is what I said, and I forwarded to Mr. Mayor that I think accomplishes the desired result without some of the unintended consequences that would flow from what's currently in this draft. So I think we've got a path to clean all that up and remove all of the land use hurdles that we might potentially have because of this change of use. So happy to answer any questions you might have. I did forward those to Mr. Mayor. So hopefully when the dash ones get finalized, it'll have something that's
Thank you. Representative Leininger.
Thank you. So, I think one of the things that we're trying to do right now is think through together what is in this draft and help people in the community understand what is potentially in the draft. And I think a lot of people realize that one potential barrier for producers who are in the OMMP system to come into the OHA-regulated system, to come into the Oregon Liquor Control Commission licensed system, is potentially land use issues, right? Because people who historically produced in the OMMP program maybe were not considered commercial users, and so maybe they had the opportunity to produce on land that, if they become OLCC licensed users, could start be presenting problems for compatibility. And so one of the key issues for people in the regulated community to be thinking about is there's a strong effort being made to find a path forward for people who find themselves in that exact position to be able to have a pathway into the OLCC regulated system so they could still produce for medical consumers but also have the potential to sell into the OLCC regulated adult use market and be licensed under the OLCC system, notwithstanding the fact that they started out on land that has some issues of that type. So as you're thinking through how you feel about this work, please give special attention to that evolving piece, because there's been a really strong effort being made to help people find a path forward into this larger market in a way that works for the business that they have built.
And Kutcher Leininger, if I could just add, I think I would agree with everything you just said, but there's also another group of folks that are technically today non-compliant and in violation of existing land use codes that are growing medical marijuana. And the goal of what I crafted here this morning is to protect them. And basically, they behave nicely, nobody complains, nothing happens. And so I don't want to create a system that takes them from non-compliant but nobody cares to non-compliant times two, and then we have to do something. So I want to protect not just the people that are legal now and make sure they remain legal, but the people that are illegal but are being tolerated can continue to be illegal but tolerated, if that makes sense.
Okay, so it's a moving target, but I think one of the unspoken issues that face is a lot of good-hearted people who are trying to make a living in this sector is being thought about, and we're trying to help find a path forward. So take a look at that with that in mind.
Thank you. All right, other questions? Thank you for your work on this, and keep it up. Mr. Morris.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Donald Morris, and I am representing the members of the Oregon Cannabis Business Council. Based on Mr. Meyer's explanation of the Dash Ones, I feel that this is a good start at representing what was many hours of work in a work group assembled by the OLCC not too long ago. We feel that it's our best option for unifying and regulating two marijuana systems that we have today. The status quo that we have today would keep patients at high risk of losing growers because of market forces and expensive testing. Every effort has been taken in this Dash One to allow for patient needs. We've created the Tier 1 and the Tier 2 micro canopies, and you've heard about the bump ups that were put forth by OLCC. This Dash 1 will also tighten up control of cannabis, giving us the best system to comply with the Cole memoranda. For us, it simplifies the marketplace and allows businesses in all sectors to operate under the same set of rules and regulations, which is going to eliminate unnecessary cost for all types of businesses up and down the sector, including a lot of ancillary businesses. And this will create two separate committees to guide the OHA and the OLCC as we further refine and regulate the marketplace. So overall, we'd like to say that this is an excellent first draft and go at this, and we hope to be of assistance in moving things further forward. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Questions from the committee? Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, just a comment, if I could. That's the first reference I've heard to Cole in a while. And I guess just for the sake of the committee, Cole has gone with the wind. We have no idea what the feds are going to do, and so I think we need to be focused on building a program that works for Oregon, and we'll deal with the consequences after that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next we'll have a panel, Anthony Taylor, Cheryl Smith, and John Sejo. To go first,
I'll take off. I was hoping that my PowerPoint would be ready to go. Are we queued
up? How long will this be? Because we have quite a few witnesses.
It's going to be a while.
Well, we need to limit you to 5 minutes.
I will try and limit that.
Yeah, we need to limit you to 5 minutes.
As much as possible. Madam Co-Chair, members of the panel, my name is Anthony Taylor, and I am the president of Compassionate Oregon, a nonprofit organization advocating for medical marijuana patients. Before I really get started, I wanted to share with the committee a statement in a report released by the Americans for Safe Access last week, and it was a report that graded all the state medical marijuana programs from A to Z, with a grading scale from, you know, A to F. Nobody received an A, but Oregon received a B, and this comment. Oregonians continue to have one of the strongest medical cannabis programs for patients in the nation. The state would be wise to maintain this impressive program that serves the needs of its patients and avoid temptation to merge the medical program with the state's recently adopted adult use system. We couldn't agree with this more. My testimony is based primarily on how the bill was written when introduced. I know we're addressing the dash ones, but I'd like to offer just a little bit of background as to why we did this. So we came into this session with two objectives. One is to relieve the Oregon Health Authority of its responsibility for administering the OMMP, and the second was to shift OMMP growers growing for others to the Department of Agriculture. We did support some regulatory consolidation based simply on organizational structure and felt it important to include these proposals in our bill as well as have them listed here. That eliminate OHA processors for obvious reasons, bring OHA dispensers under OLCC, which is a little tricky, streamline the reporting by having both systems report into one, and then end the patient and grower fees from being used to subsidize other OHA programs. So as we said before, our basic premise was that the adult use and medical programs are two distinct programs, and for many reasons, these programs need to remain separate, and that the line between them should be bright and the distinctions clear. Certainly, there are similar requirements, as I just stated, in both systems, such as testing, processing, and reporting that would fit well into consolidation. Merging the two systems completely, however, would be crossing the line between commerce and compassion, making it more difficult to determine that line for both industry and patients and state and federal regulators. We also felt it important for the state to administer these programs efficiently and that they should approach regulation by determining the different features of the regulatory structure and assign them to the appropriate agencies. It is not too late to still do this. So to help us sort this out, we drafted our own organizational chart based on how we thought we should approach this task. This is not a final chart by any means, but it gave us a starting point, something we could look at to really understand what we were trying to accomplish. This is the chart we came up with. Now, further down in the presentation, this chart is broken into the three different agencies, OLCC, OHA, and Department of Ag. As you can see, we support OLCC administering the wholesale and retail distribution and the oversight of high-potency processors. The OHA should deal with research, continue with lab accreditations, their shared role in food manufacturing, and finally, the Medical Use of Cannabis Board, which administers the OMMP. So to meet our first goal, we developed the medical, you know, created the Medical Use of Cannabis Board, which is carried through in the dash ones. and to meet our second goal, we intended to do three things. Protect growers, OMMP growers, from becoming intertwined with OLCC growers. This puts patients at risk. Provide additional protection from federal intervention and enforcement should recent statements by the new administration regarding recreational marijuana be followed through on. And three, to begin moving all cannabis cultivation to the Department of Agriculture where it should be. A couple of other points. Elimination of the OHA processors is a logical next step as well. Processors involved with producing high-potency oils and other extracts are really producing medical products and in the regulatory system should be treated no different than the labs. Consolidating processors would save the state money, eliminate confusion, and take this off OHA's plate. This is an important thing about our organizational structure, is moving these growers, all growers eventually, over to ODA creates a lot of, it takes a lot of stuff off the plates of OLCC and OHA and allows them to better focus on what they're good at doing while allowing the Department of Ag to deal with cultivation, which they're good at doing. OHA dispensaries is a little tricky. It's a logical step, but again, it's we're faced with the local jurisdiction issues. And until we can address this and make sure that those people that are in counties that, like Marion County and Douglas County, that prohibit, on this side of the mountains, that prohibit OLCC licenses and the land use regulations.
Let me break in here, Anthony. I see this presentation. We have it on OLIS.
Yes, ma'am.
It's quite long, so if you could summarize it, because otherwise other people in the room will not have a chance to testify.
Yes, ma'am. We just feel that a regulatory scheme that provides only one option for growers and regulators facing a patchwork of local ordinances that vary from city to city and county by county will force many growers to opt out of the legal options. Growers will grow their 6 medical, their 4 recreational, with no oversight at all, and excess produced by these folks will likely find its way into unregulated markets. We know that relocation, whether it falls to OLCC or ODA, will cost money, but whichever agency, that money will have to be spent. So finally, the real costs here, though, are the costs facing Oregonians that benefit from cannabis, and we often lose sight of this in this discussion about commerce versus compassion. When patients are forced to pay retail prices they cannot afford because integration has made their medicine too expensive or unavailable entirely, or patients find themselves still unable to find a grower, we are putting our medical marijuana program and its patients at risk. The bright line we established needs to be there. And in conclusion, I think that this bill does offer a different approach. And if followed and adopted, it will allow us to clearly define what program is what agency is in charge of what sectors, and you know, I just think that we should really consider it. I know that the Dash Ones have a long ways to go, and I think that I will do the best I can to help this process along, but we certainly can't support the Dash One.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Sejo.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Sejo. I'm the president of the Umpqua Cannabis Association and a longtime activist for ending marijuana prohibition. Before commenting on the current bill, let me just reflect on my deep frustration with where things have gone. As I wrote to you a few weeks ago, I think overregulation, which is rampant, threatens all the goals that the citizens supported in passing Measure 91. Some of those goals were protecting the Medical Marijuana Act, which I think is threatened by the Dash Ones and many of the other regulations. Another goal was to eliminate the black market and bring the people that were part of that into the light. I think we're failing at that. In fact, I suspect that the black market in Oregon is the largest now than it ever has been. Another goal was to generate revenue for the state of Oregon, and while some people are celebrating that we brought in about $60 million, I'm frustrated because I know we could have brought in many times more of that with leaner, more focused regulation. So I'm deeply frustrated with where things are, and as for full disclosure, I'm in conversations with other activists about taking these issues back to the voters with another initiative. That's how frustrated we are. I think there's been a lot of effort to build these elaborate systems of regulation that are so complex they just will never work. And the OLCC or the ODA or whoever it is, the OHA, simply cannot enforce their own rules. You know, I saw a report recently that, you know, a lot of this is about seed to sale tracking. The medical growers can't sell in the OLCC stores because they're not seed to sale tracked. Well, the news story I saw said 20% of OLCC licensees aren't even doing the reporting that they're supposed to do, and no one's gotten into whether or not the reporting that is being done is accurate. it may be possible that the largest source of diversion in Oregon right now is the OLCC system. And we know there's some of it. Some of it's reflected in news stories. There was a story about James Bowman being robbed. He's an OLCC grower. It reported that hundreds of pounds of marijuana were stolen. That went into the underground market. I just read a story out of the Boise newspaper talking about the two marijuana OLCC stores in Huntington, Oregon, that sell most of their marijuana to people from Idaho. But you're worried about the medical growers. I just don't get it. And frankly, the idea that seed-to-sale tracking stops anybody with a few thousand pounds of marijuana from slipping a few hundred pounds out the back door, I find preposterous. And so we're building more and more elaborate, complex systems that the little guy can't possibly follow, and the big guy can work around, and none of it's serving the goals. As for the coal memo, I agree with Senator Cruz. The coal memo is gone, but even the coal memo, James Cole said in testimony to Congress at one point that what we're not looking for is something that looks good on paper but doesn't work. Oregon has spent a lot of effort building these elaborate systems that may look good on paper, but they don't work. So having said that, I support 2198. I support the idea of moving marijuana to the Department of Ag. That's who should regulate a farm crop. As you know, all these pesticide issues, a lot of this has been worked out, and I think we should apply the same standards we apply to other things to marijuana. I think it would be simpler and it would work. In the testing realm, I also see that it's a punitive approach. And, you know, most of the marijuana in the state of Oregon doesn't go through that system. The people that are growing their four plants are the growers that are providing for patients or someone that's doing it just illicitly. None of that is tested. And what we really need, if we're concerned about public health, is to make sure all the marijuana is safe. And the way we do that is we educate. First, we find out what pesticides are truly dangerous and which practices should be avoided, and we make sure everybody understands that. By making the system so elaborate, you're just driving more and more people underground, and that means more and more of the marijuana is not going to be going through any testing anyway.
Can you do a wrap up? That would be great.
Okay, well, I think I've basically made my point. I support moving medical growers and all farmers to the Department of Ag where it belongs. I don't support moving the medical growers to the OLCC system. I can tell you that most people I talk out there in the OMMP world consider that the nail on the coffin of medical marijuana in Oregon, and they're deeply concerned about it. I hope that we can get to a point where we're tracking the results of marijuana and the outcomes for patients undergoing cancer, so that, you know, I mean, here we are 3 years into legalizing marijuana, and we still have no more guidance for patients that are using marijuana for cancer than we did a few years ago, but we're tracking every little marijuana plant. I think it's crazy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Smith.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, I had submitted comments on 2198, and then I found the Dash 1 amendments, and so I have a few comments on that.
Put your name on the record.
Yes, my name is Cheryl Smith. I am the current chair of the Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana, and I'm also a director and founding member of Compassionate Oregon. I previously was executive director of Compassion Center in Eugene, which is a medical marijuana clinic, or was, because it's now died, too. As I said, I have comments on the record for 2198, but I now want to address the Dash 1 somewhat. It's obviously so long, I can't go into a lot of detail. I agree with both Anthony and John that marijuana belongs in the Department of Ag. It's an agricultural product. They're the experts on growing things, and so it was really sorely disappointed to see that removed in these amendments. I also support the Medical Use of Cannabis Board. I think this bill came about because nearly everyone was dissatisfied with OHA management of the OMMP. OHA has never supported the medical marijuana program, and for probably the past decade, it's simply been used as a cash cow to fund other admittedly valuable OHA services, such as safe drinking water, midwives, and EMTs. We have an almost 20-year-old medical cannabis program, yet research is virtually non-existent. Patients and their growers are being gouged, and the OHA has not made any effort to bring the program into the mainstream medical system. These are some of the issues that I think are important. We have a national heroin and opioid abuse epidemic, and there are numerous studies that have been coming out on that, showing that the death rate in states with medical marijuana programs is much lower than it is in states that don't have them. And I believe that there's a correlation. Having run a clinic, I saw that. I heard it from patients over and over. They were able to decrease their prescription opioids, and in many cases, they were able to quit taking them altogether. So where's OHA and public health? When it comes to medical cannabis, the OHA is basically MIA. So I think this medical use of cannabis board is good. Although it would sit under the OHA, it obviously has a lot more power than what ACM ever had. And I've been on the ACMM for 4 years, and I attended meetings for probably 4 years prior to that and saw over and over that things didn't happen the way they should. I didn't see in the dash ones that the ACMM was taken away, so that seems a little redundant that you'd have an ACMM and a medical use of cannabis board. So those are my main concerns, and I realize that you have limited time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I want to call the committee's attention to your written testimony that's in COLAS.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? All right. Thank you very much. Our next panelists will be Noreen Arnold, Mike Kirkwood, and Leland Berger.
My name is Leland Berger. I am chair of the Portland Normals Legislative Committee. We lobby on behalf of consumers. I did want to speak briefly to what some of the concerns the last panel raised. I was the first lawyer on the advisory committee for medical marijuana, and I understand and appreciate the frustration that my friend John Sajo feels. You know, 20 years ago, he and I and the late Jack Herrer and Michael Rose, a lawyer in Portland, started Voter Power. We ran initiatives during the 2000s, and because he lives in rural Douglas County, he's not able to do what he's been doing. He's provided thousands of pounds of medicine to patients over the years, and so I understand his frustrations. Having said that, and notwithstanding that it is a good idea to treat it as an agricultural crop, I've said publicly and privately, and I'll share with the committee, my view is that of the legalized states, Oregon's done the best job of melding the medical and adult use distribution systems by allowing licensed producers to cultivate for patients. In the Dash 1 amendments, you add allowing adult use processors to process patients' medicine into oil, to allow patients to shop tax-free at dispensaries and receive some medicines that healthy adults can't have, and others in higher dosages. Of any of the legalized states so far, I think it's the best melding. I think it's problematic in some respects, but I did want to say that. The Portland Normals Legislative Committee meets monthly on the second Monday. We met last night, and I asked everybody to read the 386 pages of the Dash 1 amendments by today. And I got through the first batch, and I am trusting Mr. Mayor that the second batch is conforming amendments and nothing substantive. But I had just two brief things that caught my eye, and I wrote them down, the section number and the page number, and I left that sheet at home. Mr. Crawford and Mr. Mayor were saying that the committee is keeping comments open for a couple of days, so I can provide comments tomorrow or the next day and post them. So these are the two things. I don't know why the authority of of the agency, whatever the agency is going to be, to adopt new conditions for medical marijuana is deleted. I think that's anti-science. I have petitioned the health authority in 2000 on a series of conditions. In 2006 on PTSD, it was denied. And in 2013, the legislature passed it. So from a legislative standpoint, I think it makes sense to have the opportunity for the agency to make these decisions in the first place and have the legislature or, as John mentioned, the initiative, the people acting as a coextensive branch of the legislature through the initiative to be able to do that if the agency doesn't act. And I mention that because I've been busy with other matters, but I'm planning shortly to file a petition with the health authority to add withdrawal from opioid addiction as a debilitating medical condition under the Medical Marijuana Act. I have a friend who is a cancer survivor, and she found cannabis. She became addicted to opioids as a part of the pain from the surgeries, removing the tumors and whatnot, and found cannabis helpful for that. And as Ms. Smith mentioned, in the 25 medical legal states, the death rate from opioid abuse is the lowest, and there's other science that supports that, and taking that away from the health authority or from the board or from whoever is a bad idea, and I would encourage you to not do that. The second thing is that concerns the Rules Advisory Committee for the new Oregon Liquor Control and Cannabis Commission, and I think it should have a member on it, or the Portland Normal thinks it should have a member on it, that represents consumers. And I had spoken with Director Marks from the OLCC about this when he organized the first Rules Advisory Committee, and it didn't happen for that, but this gives us an opportunity to make sure that consumers have a seat at the table in deciding what the rules are going to be and whether the rules are fair to consumers. And I think 2 or 3 years after legalization, it's appropriate to start recognizing that we need a seat at the table. So I appreciate, as always, the opportunity to speak with you publicly and as well as privately, and I appreciate your patience with me today. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for wading through the long draft. Okay, who has to go next?
Noreen Arnold from Spring Oil Organics. I started my little company a year and a half ago. I had bought my property in Douglas County 2 weeks after the house closed. They put the ban on. I have not been able to make any money yet because what I have going isn't ever going to put a whole pound of pot out there because I take care of my 6 patients that I have. And so I'm buying groceries on my credit card and borrowing money to pay my bills because everything that I used to do out of my scraps I am no longer allowed to do, which is make butter and cookies and things like that. So I have to have a processing license now, which my property will not accommodate because it's residential. So just that's one thing to consider for you guys. Something else, you don't test all the testing, you don't test for mold. If a patient smokes moldy pot, they will get a respiratory infection and be sick for months. And yet that is something that isn't even tested for anymore, unless you pay extra for that test. So if what I heard was last summer, 80% of the pot that was grown was molded. They still tried to sell it, but the clubs wouldn't take it. So, you know, it's like if you have to, and once I've taken my whole pound of pot to the testing place, which is going to be months before I save up enough to do that because I do a push-pull method instead of a whole batch at a time because I'm not physically able to do that. As far as getting all 48 of my plants down at one time, you know, it's not possible. So I only take a few out every week. I don't know. Yeah, you know, It's not cost-effective for anything. That a $300 test, I can't come up with $300. And to do that, even as a medical grower, because that's not, I can't have somebody come batch test my stuff and everything be good for 6 months, because I don't use pesticides on my marijuana. I am very sensitive to everything. I don't even put bat guano on my marijuana because that will give me a reaction. So, I don't know, it just seems that things have gotten really bad. I know growers that have the same problems. I don't have a black market anymore, because 16 years ago when I started growing for myself, all of my other people who we all used to get pot together all grow their own now. I don't have anybody who I can go sell mine to. And I, anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leininger, members of the committee, thank you for having me. For the record, my name is Mike Kirkwood. I'm CEO of a small wholesaler in the state of Oregon called EEK. Please feel free to ask questions at any time. We are both a software integrator. We have integrated with Franwell and the Metric system and have access to their back-end data, as a number of other companies have done. And we're also approved by the OLCC as a wholesaler. We wanted to mention that we feel that both Franwell, Metric, and the OLCC have done a fantastic job of servicing us and dealing with all the complexity of the system. But we have a number of suggestions for 2018 as part of a 2198 Amendment 1. First, our suggestion is that small farms, medical farms, should be allowed to opt in and sell their medical product to the rec marketplace. And we believe that they should be able to do that by paying a small fee if they want to have access to Metric, so all their products are tested, that equals the fee that the state pays to Metric. And that's it. They shouldn't have to opt into any other cameras, security protocols, because they're not doing that today. They should be able to do that, or opt in to transferring it to another producer or wholesaler who's willing to put in their plants, harvests, batches, and packages into Metric. That will allow a medical producer to transfer into the system and for it to be seed to sale at the same time in a very reasonable way that costs very little. The second thing that we suggest is that, similar to what's being considered in Senate Bill 316 for the Oregon Wine Board, that the OLCC be asked to put in money to create the Oregon Marijuana Board, specifically a marketing committee just like the Wine Board. This industry has a larger market potential than other industries that the OLCC manages, and we've already exceeded the numbers of licensees. We're in a cash positive situation, and we should be promoting this industry to other places outside of Oregon, because Oregon has special conditions. We're a very special producer of this crop. Thirdly, we suggest that the pesticides continue to be tested and tested on all batches. Although we do agree with the control measures that are being suggested, we do not believe, similar to what Co-Vice Chair Fahey was asking earlier, that if it's been tested and it still comes out as being positive because it's been concentrated, that it still has pesticides. It's really pretty simple. Yes, we understand that there's a massive challenge in the marketplace. There's a lot of products that have been held up. But the reality of it is that Oregon's crop is worth more if it's organic and it's healthy. Not just today, not just to consumers, but the entire industry in the state. We do not want to give that up because of efficiency, because of quickness. Finally, the name of recreational should be changed to compassionate. It is not a recreational product or a medical product. It is just a product. People use it for both things in multiple contexts. And it is not a replacement for alcohol. It is not a product that you go buy because you're going to go recreate all the time. The name is wrong, and it should be considered to be changed. Finally, our biggest point related to coming here today is that we believe Oregon is in a very strong position and should be promoting exports to the federal government, to other countries, and other states. We've suggested a number of measures in that and some suggested legislative actions that are attached, and we believe that Oregon's future is to be an exporter, the exporter of the highest quality product in the world. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Our next panel will be Mike Rockland, Jerry Wade, and Peter Gendron.
Good evening, Madam Co-Chairs, Joint Committee. My name is Mike Rockland. I've testified many times before. And primarily I want to pick up on what people have talked about with medical. I'm a licensed health professional, and I've spoken to many physicians, naturopaths, and others in the last 2 months. There still is a significant stigma and lack of acceptance of medical use of cannabis. For a lot of reasons, but mostly because they don't teach it in schools.
Back off the
mic. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you.
So
way back.
Yeah. More?
Yeah.
Yep. Is that okay?
Yeah,
testing.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. So what I want to say is currently naturopaths or physicians are not allowed, as well as nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, to authorize medical use. That's a huge barrier. And we haven't had the research or the education to allow them to understand this. So what I'm asking is, for example, some of the fees would be appropriate to use for that purpose. But in terms of the regulation, or not the regulation, the statute itself, I'm for the original version, not the dash one, because it throws too many barriers in a way of not only medical patients, but providers, as well as users in general of cannabis. Anything we do to regulate and essentially inhibit the cannabis growers, especially the medical growers, by adding more restriction, less testing on the commercial side, but more restriction on the medical side, increases costs, adds to problems with things that end up being illegal. So my thought is that, you know, we've done a lot in the last 2 years. People are now smarter. The conversation's opening more. But the actual conversation needs to go to a higher level. And all these rules have kind of not only confused people, but also probably gotten in the way of helping us along. So one of the things would be that, 298 is good in its intention, but having the crosstalk, the interagency agreements, for example, with pesticides, Oregon OSHA, DEQ, they have already interagency agreements for work practices for workers. They're just starting to talk about that now. There's a two-day symposium tomorrow on this very subject with interagency. So I applaud that effort. That's what needs to happen. I think we got the cart in front of the horse a little bit. We've done good things, but stepping back a little bit, cannabis is medicine. It can be used as medicine. For consumers, it's great, but there's a different level of testing and quality that's needed. So I'm all for making sure that it's safe and effective, but when the balance is off and the commercial industry has, if you will, less restrictive areas, the price for medical is going to go up. The restrictions are there. I've seen over the past 6 months the supply dry up for medical patients. The costs go up 4 to 5 times for medical patients. That's a huge barrier. A lot of people can't afford it in the patients that I see. So I'm just I think we're now coming to realize the effects, the unintended consequences we have. So as we go forward, I'd like to see a little bit more crosstalk. And I think that the safe access is key, not just for patients, but providers, being able, medical providers, to be able to allow, because this is happening anyway. I've had doctors tell me that, you know, their patients are using. We need to know more. So that's really a key to this whole thing, I think, as far as medical. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who wants to go next?
Hi, my name is Jerry Wade, and I'm with the Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation. Stormy Ray was one of the chief petitioners that started Measure 67 that began our program back in 1998. And I've been an advocate for this program for about 18 years. And I've taken about the last 2 years off because of esophageal cancer that I had about a 5% chance of living through. And one of the things that I believe is the reason I'm still sitting here before you today is Rick Simpson oil or concentrates that I used, and along with my chemotherapy and my radiation therapy and other things, my doctors did not expect me to live. And today I am 100% cancer free. And the doctors, let's just say the head of OHSU's cancer radiation department, Dr. Thompson, is my doctor, and he just signed my card again about a week ago and is very strongly in support of medical marijuana.
Okay, now, if you could comment on the actual bill, that would be
great.
Where
I'm getting at is the new laws and legislations that have passed over the last few years have done a couple of things that have really hurt patients. One, an individual single patient growing for themselves is no longer allowed to make edibles, concentrates, or Rick Simpson oil themselves. They have to take it someplace else, which in many times makes that out of the price range of somebody. The reason somebody grows for themselves is because they can't afford to go to a dispensary or buy it from somebody else. And to take that option away from a patient who has no intention of reselling that Rick Simpson oil or making it a commercial property, but simply just taking it out of their hands and saying it is illegal there for them to produce it themselves, which quadruples, just unbelievably marks up what it's going to cost for that patient to have that medicine available to them, is wrong, and that should not be blocked from patients. And my second real concern from what I've seen is the combination or combining the Oregon Liquor Control Commission with the Oregon Health Department, the medical marijuana program. How would you like to have to go buy your prescription medicine at the local bar? Put it in that context. That's where you're pitting medical marijuana patients. You're pitting us under an alcohol, a recreational drug, something that is sold for pleasure. And the people that use this medication are using it for medicine. And as the doctor said here on the end, there's still a very strong stigma. There's still a lot of people out there that say that there's no such thing as medical marijuana. This is just a way around the law. I'm living proof sitting here before you that that is not true. And please take into consideration, do not combine these two departments and put us under the Oregon Liquor Control Board. Right now, I have heard no less than probably a dozen interviews from Jeff Sessions over the last 2 months. Part of them, if any of you happen to be able to watch any of the Senate confirmation hearings, he has every intention of applying the law as it is written, federal law, to marijuana laws in this country. He has said so openly, and it is part of his agenda. He has also said in Forbes and in several other noted articles that they plan to make an exception for medical marijuana and states that have enacted medical marijuana laws. Combining these two programs into one program, I believe, will put our entire program at risk in the next year when the Attorney General's office decides to start cracking down on marijuana in the states. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee.
My name is Peter Gendron. Thank you for allowing me this time to share opinions on these important matters with you tonight. The Oregon Sun-Grown Growers Guild was established prior to the passage of Measure 91 to protect and defend our growers and patients and their relationships. After re-legalization, we've also become involved in the regulatory process with a keen eye to preserving and protecting the grower-patient relationship that has been established in Oregon for almost two decades now. As president of the Guild, myself and many of my board members have sat on committees implementing Measure 91. Regardless of which bills passed this year, we continue to support the involvement of patients and growers in this process and support their traditional relationships. Thank you for allowing me to present these ideas on behalf of the OSGG. Tonight I'm here to address House Bill 2198 as originally written and the concept of integration proposals being considered this session. The OSGG is opposed to merging the medical and recreational programs at this time. Although there has been much discussion about what proper implementation of Measure 91 looks like, there is agreement that given the current political climate at the federal level, the programs must remain unique and distinct. We are also concerned that OLCC-related proposals will effectively end the grower-patient relationship as we know it. Areas of concern include proposals that would prevent a mom and pop from each having a medical card and growing for their own use at home. This is what Measure 67 allows. And not being able to cultivate 12 plants for personal use, as has been the custom since 1998, is against both the letter and the spirit of Measure 91, which stated that implementation will not affect the existing medical program. Our more enlightened officials have come to understand that we are talking about the same plant in either case. But as long as these programs are regarded through a different lens, protection of a robust medical program is crucial to the success of Oregon's implementation goals and the health and welfare of our patients. There's much discussion about the financial benefits of a successful adult use program, but we hear little about the millions the philanthropic efforts of our medical growers have saved the Oregon Health Plan over the years. Main areas of savings include reduced dependence on opioid pain medication and a general reduction in harm done by overprescription of other medications. Benefits include improved quality of life for people who have access to medical marijuana. The OMMP was never designed to be a revenue-generating policy. When considering that over 40% of cardholders qualify for a means-tested reduction in fees, this money is truly being taken from some of the poorest Oregonians. Although this is not a large sum in the scope of Oregon's budget, it's financially significant to the people paying these fees. In fact, with the increase in fees required last year by the OHA, participation in the OMMP has waned. Some of the people who would benefit the most are simply priced out of access now. Although there is substantial anecdotal evidence to demonstrate the benefits of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, there's little real data to back it up. Why? Because of the hands-off approach the OHA has taken to this vital and popular policy. Over the years, little effort has been made to quantify the benefits of our surplus contributions. One way to remedy this would be through the creation of an autonomous medical use of cannabis board to manage and account for this program. I serve by appointment of the governor on the Senate Bill 844 implementation task force, along with Representative Wilson last year. One of the recommendations we made back to the legislature was the creation of the Oregon Cannabis Research Institute, an agency which could oversee both the existing OMMP and conduct research to bolster the state's position on cannabis policies. Ideas like this are mirrored in the proposal of an Oregon Cannabis Commission under Senate Bill 300 this year, which we also find complementary to House Bill 2198 as originally drafted. The Oregon Department of Agriculture is currently in charge of testing for hemp, and this is a natural fit for regulating marijuana production as well. We've clarified in law that this is a farm use crop, and as such, it makes sense to have control assigned to the agency which already oversees the production of all other agricultural commodities. From a regulatory point of view, it makes sense to put oversight of cannabis production in the hands of the agency which has the best infrastructure already built to oversee production of this commodity. Research could be better facilitated under either of these models, and with clear direction, we are sure the agencies involved would help maintain Oregon's gold standard for cannabis. First, do no harm. This is the easiest way to summarize the Hippocratic Oath. I urge the committee to consider this carefully when making decisions affecting the health of all of our cannabis programs. Additionally, please consider the things state agencies are already tasked with when looking at program costs and viability. In the case of cannabis, it makes sense to have direct oversight from professionals in the field for this growing industry. This may mean some additional expense, but greatly increased benefits to Oregon from both practical and legal points of view when looking at creating a program that could eventually cover all cannabis production in Oregon. There's no hurry here as we move forward with laws designed to develop these programs with a keen eye to the interests of public health and safety for all Oregon. Thank you again this evening for your valuable time.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Thank you very much. Okay, our final witness is Peter Kramer.
Madam Chairman and other committee members, thank you for hearing us. The medical patients, they use
cannabis. Can you give your name?
Oh, it's, my name is Peter Kramer from Mercy. I go by PK. We're here to help the patient. We were a patient for 15 years. We've seen a lot of things that happened to our organization. Refunding money to other parts of our health department. When 91 was proposed, that nothing would happen to the medical program. Well, look what happened. I wrote you out a testimonial, I believe you got it. It's about Section 20 of our state's constitution, that we all should be treated equally. I don't see that. I see one patient, he pays the full amount. I see another patient like I, pays the minimum amount. Why is that? Can you answer it?
This is for you to testify.
I am. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I agree what Anthony Taylor and John Sajo, Lee Berger, Pioneer P, and all the other people. The main thing in your testing, remember mold. The patient, or even a regular person, if they would smoke or use moldy cannabis, they would have lung trouble. And that's serious thing. The lungs is our life. We breathe. Thank you, and have a good day.
Thank you, you too. Okay.
And I hope you take what I wrote to you. Did you read it?
We will. Senator Pruszynski.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, I do want to put this in. I had some difficulty, and I think other people who are using our OLA system to get to the meeting materials. I went to the bill itself, and just when it was the face page for the bill, it only had the 6 testimonials. And so for those who are following it right now, you have to be on the Joint Committee's main page and hit the meetings materials to get the whole thing. So I'm hoping that we can correct that, because a lot of people are going to go to the bill looking for something. They're only going to see those 6 testimonials, not all of this other stuff. So if we can do that, it hopefully will give less confusion for those out in cyber world.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we can definitely make that change.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, PK.
Have a good night.
You too. And just as a comment, this is a very long amendment, and I would want to call the attention of the people who testified for the medical program on the structure of the micro tier that's in the -1 amendment. That is a small tier that's designed to actually provide free medicine to medical patients provide a pretty strong incentive for that. So it's going to be a work in progress, but I appreciate all of your testimony tonight, and it will be very helpful. So thank you. So committee, with that, you're adjourned. You're adjourned.